Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is Neat. It's a weekly booze cast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
I'm excited about this episode, but before we get right into it, how you doing, Liz? How's your week? How you holding up?
I'm good. It's warmer outside in New York City, So I have been spending some evenings on my fire escape, or as me and my roommate that share the fire escape sometimes accidentally on purpose call the terrace.
You know, that is a New York City terrace, actually. That is what that is.
Yeah, no, she accidentally called it a terrace, and I was like, it's okay, we can call it a terrace.
Yeah,
actually, lately when I FaceTime with Teresa and BB wants to see my rooms. Okay. She wants to see the rest of the house, and I have shown her the rest of the house. Like, it's not like I haven't. I did. Like, I did an obligatory, like, okay, I'll show you the rooms. Here are the rooms. But I was really excited to show her my fire escape because it looks really cool out there. So by showing her my fire escape, I had to explain to her, to a three-year-old who lives in Ohio, what a fire escape is, what a New York fire escape is, because she has no concept of what that means. Oh. But she's very, very smart. Like, so I took the FaceTime out there and I showed her and I explained that in, like, I live in an apartment building with other people in the building. So I live on the second floor. And if there was a fire, if I couldn't get out the front door, then I would escape out the fire escape. So I showed her the ladder and the stairs and everything, and she knows what a balcony is because she stayed at a hotel. So okay, she knows what a balcony is. So it's like a balcony, but
with stairs.
It's with stairs, and there's a ladder that if we needed to get out of the building because of a fire, we could put the fire escape down. So now every time we FaceTime, I show her the fire escape. And she says, can you show me how you escape?
No, that's illegal.
I say, I could show you the ladder that I would use if I had to escape. I've used in one of my previous apartments, I have used the ladder because I locked myself out I locked myself out of my apartment, but I could get into the kind of like courtyard area where they kept the trash and stuff because sometimes that door would open. So I could see my bedroom window. So one time I actually I didn't have my keys. I had to get, and there was no one home. So I had to break into my bedroom or I had to break into my apartment. Because I also knew that I had left the window unlocked, so I had to stand on a dumpster. The fire escape ladders only come down to the ground if you unhook them. It wasn't unhooked, so I had to jump to the first rung and lift myself up onto the ladder. And I didn't and it's like a lot of New York fire escapes are kind of like rusted. So I just tore the shit out of my palms. And nice. But then when I got up on my fire escape, I realized that I actually had locked my bedroom window. So I had to get into the bathroom window instead that had a really high window. So I undid the bathroom window, and then I just did a nosedive into my bathtub.
Oh, wow.
But so that's New York fire escapes for you. It was fine. I got in. That was great. That was the success, that I got into my apartment without my keys. But it also does show how easy it would be for someone to break into my apartment if they wanted to. Good thing I didn't have anything valuable except for my life. What's been going on with you?
I have been back at my bar a lot more frequently. We are currently working on reopening's not going to happen for a very long time in New York, but like a lot of bars in our area are doing to-go cocktail menus. My bar decided not to do it at first, just stay closed completely, you know, like get everybody on unemployment, do what you have to do, like that. You know, I respect that decision, but we're at the point now where you realize how long this is going to last. And like, I think there are those of us that would, you know, be happy to like make some cocktails to go, you know, like have some sort of work to go
yeah.
to.
Yeah.
People, especially people that haven't been able to figure out unemployment. Some people have been rejected or have
for
been
a lot
vetted.
Of people, it's a nightmare.
Yeah. So,
yeah,
I was asked to come up with a new fully to go cocktail menu. And
oh, nice.
You know, this has been the just the luck of my bar this past year. We had a fire back in last July, I guess. And that
that was a while ago.
Yeah, that closed us up until this January. So it was right before I was launching. I was building my fall menu, and I do like 4 menu changes a year, but 2 major ones and 2 small ones. So the fall menu and the summer menu are my like kind of my big menus. That's when, you know, it's mm-hmm. fall goes into the seat, like the holidays, everybody wants to like drink, it's a party time. And then in summer, everybody's outside, we open our whole like outside patio, so it's another big cocktail
right
time. Like the winter menu is very small, it's a slow time for the industry. Like the and by winter mm-hmm. I mean like January, February, March, like
yeah, first quarter as we refer to it in the biz.
Yeah, that menu is usually built around what do I have left in the liquor cabinet that I need to go through. Like what can I make that's cheap because everybody's out of money, the restaurants aren't making money, my customers don't have money. Like that's kind of a cheap menu. So we were closed up until January. I got to do my kind of like survival menu in January. And then I was so excited for this menu, for this summer menu that was supposed to launch. Usually launch around the beginning of April. So that's when all of this happened, of course. So that mm-hmm. menu got scrapped. And I was definitely bummed by that. I put about a month's worth of work into developing that menu that
yeah.
just... There's no way to convert that to a to-go menu. It's just, it's complicated. No. It's a little bit more expensive. And I think, you know, like when my bosses reached out to me to like make a to-go menu, I just had to kind of get my head out of my ass and say, you know what? Getting to do anything creative right now in the realm of like bar management is something that I've missed. It's an important part of me and I should be thankful for the opportunity. And like any good bar manager, it's not about making the menu that I want to make or I want to drink. It's about making the menu that meets the demands of my clientele and like matches the parameter of what's being asked of me. So this is what's being asked of me. Like, I'm going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a couple days of like kind of R&D. It's usually, like I said, I put weeks, if not months, into developing a menu. This one, it's like figured out in a week. And I'm like, okay, this is what we're doing. We want to make cheap cocktails. We want them to be to go. We want them to be like, and like we're, you know, doing like these Capri Sun pouches that we've used like kind of as a gimmick on menus in the past. But now everything across the board is going to be that. It's going to be like, I'm building it around the concept of like a rainbow, which I've done before. I'm a very
Yay!
Aesthetic person, so it's going to be very colorful. I'm like hand designing the labels that are going to go on them, so there will be illustrations on each one. And the drinks themselves, we're going to be able to sell them at a really like affordable price point. And also like something that we can make that'll be, you know, a bit more of a focus on, because they're big drinks, like to fill the pouch. Jack.
Jack,
do you have to come in here and start screaming? But yeah, so it's been, you know, like trying to make something for what we're dealing with now. Making something that we can serve in a larger quantity that is a little bit lower alcohol, so people aren't going to be getting tanked. Like, you know, like a focus on like fresh ingredients, fresh juices, and fun, bright, whimsical packaging, silly garnishes. Just, you know, all the stuff we can do to kind of bring some joy and create a new, I don't know, a whole menu identity around it. So
yeah.
I'm psyched. It feels nice to like feel that sense of purpose again. Not that like I feel that way about my podcast, about my art, but like, I don't know, I'm somebody that does like a lot of things all the time to feel accomplished, and losing a big part of it is hard.
Yeah, obviously. Yes. That's exciting. I'm excited to walk by and get one of those. You know what? I want to taste the rainbow.
Yeah,
I'm gonna come back and get everything.
Also, anytime I can make something that's just secretly gay, it's great, you know? Like, you line them all up and like, whoops, gay pride.
But it is. It's about to be June, so.
Yeah, that's true. That's another. We're going to, for June, we'll like, you know, we'll figure out a price for like a special so that if you buy one of each, you get a big old queer discount.
Yes! I love it. Mm. Ah, yay!
Yeah, aww. So. Today on the podcast, though, we're continuing our series on great historical drinkers, I guess. I don't know. In this, we already covered Hemingway, a great American drinker. And now we're going to cover another great American drinker, Humphrey Bogart.
Bogey.
You know, we were talking before this, how before we get into researching, it's always like, man, I hope the way that I think about him holds up under research and scrutiny. And I still feel pretty good about my love of Humphrey Bogart. Yeah, as actually, before we get into his life, I do want to say that he's an important character for me personally because he's actually the reason that I bought my first cocktail shaker and made my first cocktail.
Oh, is there a story?
My first winter in New York after I graduated college and I was working like, had to work over Christmas, like on Christmas Day. I was working at this cafe, like a chain coffee shop that just was not going to let me off. And I was so broke at the time that I could not afford to, you know, quit a job just to go home for Christmas. So on a whim, I had gotten a box set of Humphrey Bogart DVDs. Just because, I don't know, something about it. I was like, I don't really know much about Humphrey Bogart, but I feel like I wanna watch some Bogart movies. And we'll come back to this, but I watched Casablanca first and decided that I wanted to. It just felt like before I continued on in my box set, I wanted to be able to make a well-made cocktail to go along with it. So I went out and I got the stuff to make a gin martini. And I noticed I said cocktail shaker. I did shake my first gin martini. Because I did not know I was 21, 22.
Right, and we had all heard shaken, not stirred. We'd had been forced down into our brain cerebrum by James Bond, so.
It's true. So, but I did, I spent that Christmas day alone, well, with Jack. Jack was there.
Aw, Jack, how old was Jack?
Jack was a baby. He was maybe a year old. Maybe. He was a baby. I had just got him when I moved into that apartment after college. So, yeah. So, he was very young. And, I spent that Christmas alone watching the rest of my Humphrey Bogart movies and making myself equal part gin martini. So, equal parts vermouth to Bombay Sapphire gin was the gin I chose. And nice. That was really where, you know, I'd worked in restaurants before. I'd been a server. At that time, I was kind of working on my barista education, but that was really when I caught the bug for mixology, for making drinks, for being a bartender. Aww. That was when I it would be another, like, I don't know, 6 years before I'd actually get to be a bartender, but that's when I began my quest to become one. So aww. Thank you, Mr. Bogart.
That's such a sweet story, and it involves Baby Jack.
Yep, me and Baby Jack on the couch on Christmas Day watching The Big Sleep, I think. The Big Sleep and To Have and Have Not. I think it specifically was a Bogart and Bacall box set.
They have great chemistry.
They did.
We'll get back into that later. But speaking of Christmas Day. Speaking of Christmas Day.
All right.
Humphrey DeForest Bogart was born on Christmas Day, December 25th, 1899, to a surgeon and a successful commercial illustrator. Maybe. Because there are some suggestions that he was actually born on January 23rd, 1900. Because,
we don't know his actual birthday?
Old Hollywood. Like, studios really just had a habit of straight up changing people's birthdays like they did with Shirley Temple. So it's actually suspected that Warner Brothers changed the date to help the image of the actor who often played unlikable or villainous characters. He played scoundrels in the beginning. Yeah, so it's kind of up in the air. I mean, it's makes for a great story. Which is what the studio loved. He always celebrated his birthday on Christmas Day. So if you wanted to celebrate Humphrey Bogart's birthday on Christmas, you wouldn't be wrong. That's when he celebrated it. Jesus wasn't even born on Christmas, so whatever, you know.
This is the first time hearing that, and I love that I was celebrating Humphrey Bogart's birthday without realizing it so many years ago, watching his movies and drinking martinis. That's fascinating. Huh.
There you go. There
you go. It was meant to be. It was fate intervening.
It was. It was. Absolutely. So, you know, either it's December 25th, 1899 or January 23rd, 1900, Humphrey Bogart's a little baby. Huh. He's a beautiful baby. He is not the Gerber baby, as some people have actually speculated. But reportedly, he was a very good-looking baby.
Oh, he's a good-looking man.
Well, he's a pretty good-looking man. I mean, and he has a quote about that. He says, "I'm not good-looking. I used to be, but not anymore. Not like Robert Taylor. What I have got is I've got character in my face. It's taken an awful lot of late nights and drinking to put it there. When I go to work in a picture, I say, don't take the lines out of my face. Leave him there." I don't know how he said that, but that's what I imagine him saying it like that.
That sounds right.
But he was a good-looking baby. His mother, being a commercial illustrator, actually did draw him and use his image for a Mellon's baby food ad.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
So not the Gerber baby, the Mellon's baby.
Yes, he was the Mellon's baby, not the Gerber baby.
All right.
He was raised in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. He had like a pretty privileged boyhood. He was a disinterested student. He went to boarding school and ended up either withdrawing from Phillips Boarding School, or he might have been expelled for pushing a groundskeeper into a rabbit pond. That story is not confirmed. A rabbit pond. That's what they called it. A rabbit pond. It's like a, you know.
Does it have anything to do with rabbits?
I think maybe like rabbits like to hang out around it, you know?
I didn't know rabbits like, is that how you get rabbits? You just install a,
you gotta make, well, you gotta
small
make a
pond?
Yeah, you need an ecosystem if you're going to have wild rabbits around. So you gotta, wow. You make you a pond. You gotta have a pond. I think so. I mean, that's what I assume. They need a source of water, rabbits, you know?
If you build it, they will come.
Yes.
And by it, I mean a pond, and by they, I mean little rabbits.
Little rabbits, yes.
Okay, all right, good to know.
Right, but so when he was 18, he went into the Navy. He did a lot better in the Navy. He was a model sailor, and he was really excited about war and specifically sexy French girls. But actually most of his sea time was spent ferrying troops home from Europe after the armistice.
Yeah, because his first like actual boating was after the armistice. The war was over. He was a little bummed by that. He missed action.
He was a little late, but maybe he got to see some sexy French girls. I don't know.
Maybe.
In any case, he was excited about the prospect of seeing them, and that's why he signed up. So, but actually, this is an interesting tidbit because this is where the studio story is that this is when he acquired his famous lip scar. Supposedly.
Which is probably not true.
Probably not true, but supposedly, like the studio likes to say, he got it in the Navy. Supposedly, somebody hit him in the mouth with like a handcuffed wrist while he was transporting a prisoner. But that story was probably just for Hollywood. Another version of the lip scar is that it was a childhood injury. Some people speculate that it could have been his dad because his dad was a surgeon and like the idea is like maybe he made his father mad. His father hit him in the face and then patched him up himself and kind of botched it. That's kind of saying that his dad was a bad surgeon, though. So I don't know about that. Yeah. It's not really, like I said, I don't want to accuse Bogart Sr. Of child abuse. I don't know. But another likely story is that he got into a bar brawl.
Yeah, just a lot of his contemporaries at the time said that they witnessed him get the scar in a barroom fight. So, yeah, in any case, it's something that became iconic for him because it slightly affected his speech patterns and a bit of like the way that he moved his mouth. So for whatever, however he got it, it ultimately helped define his his acting career.
Yeah. I mean, another thing that defined his acting career ultimately is because he spent a lot of time in speakeasies after returning from naval service.
Yeah, well, that it's kind of fascinating. I'm mystified by the generation that grew up having to deal with World War One, Prohibition, World War Two, and the Depression. And Humphrey Bogart is exactly that lifespan. Like, that is his youth into his adulthood, is World War One to Prohibition to World War Two to the Depression and on forward. So it's a really fascinating under the microscope examination of what somebody that had to live through that, like the psychological implications.
Oh my God, so much.
And I, you know, I did a lot of research into what he drank throughout his life. He was in New York. He was drinking in speakeasies. What he was known for drinking at that time was pretty rough stuff, but then that's what everybody was drinking.
Yeah.
Like, he was often attributed as enjoying a Jack Rose, which is really, it's kind of like one of the classic grenadine cocktails that we have. I don't actually think we talked about it on our grenadine episode, but I know we had somebody write in and ask, like, what can you do with grenadine, and this is kind of the go-to, which is like Applejack, which would have made sense that there would be Applejack cocktails during Prohibition because it was an American-made spirit. It was, you know, an apple derivative, like something you could probably have made.
Probably could have made it in your basement.
Yeah,
yeah.
But Applejack, limiter lime juice, and grenadine, so it's like a sour build. But he was known for enjoying an Applejack cocktail. He was known to enjoy bathtub gin martinis, which,
because at the time that was what gin was.
Yeah,
right.
So, like, and that would have been rough.
That's the option. Yeah, no, yeah, oof.
Yeah,
but that's what he came of age on.
Yeah, like, well, and that was everybody at that time, you know. That's what people were drinking. He was in New York, you know. A lot of the good bartenders had fled. The bartenders that were here were left to work with what they had. A lot of beer cocktails he drank in his youth, which I thought was kind of charming. He liked Black Velvet specifically.
Yeah.
Guinness and champagne, or probably whatever sparkling wine you could get at the time. Also Drambuie and beer, which I've heard referred to as a rusty ale, but I think that's a modern nickname. I don't think at the time they just called it Drambuie and beer.
Yeah.
He would later be judged for his drinking palate, but you have to assume anyone that came of age during Prohibition in New York City,
right?
You could get drunk, but you couldn't necessarily get drunk well.
He tried. So, like you said, he's kind of painting the town during Prohibition. That's when he's coming of age. That's when Prohibition is happening. Just because, you know, and he lives in Manhattan, so liquor wasn't actually that hard to find. Mm-hmm. He was really good friends with a guy named Bill Brady Jr. Bill Brady Jr.'s father had theater connections, owned a production company, so he got a job with him. So he tried his hand at screenwriting, directing, and production with no luck. He wasn't really good at any of it. And then he started stage managing. He liked stage managing, but then he found out that stage managers don't get rich. So that's when he decided he wanted to try acting. So he started acting in plays, and he actually just really liked the lifestyle of actors. Like, he liked the late hours they kept. He liked the attention.
One bit about his sort of young acting days that I really found charming was how he financed his drinking. He wasn't making a lot of money in his young acting days. So one thing that's weirdly true about Humphrey Bogart is he was a brilliant chess player.
Mm.
He would play chess against anyone for a dollar and would almost always win. And he would use money. Yeah, he would use that money to finance his boozing. The other thing about it was he was just charming as hell. And this account comes from, there were the speakeasies, which, even though they were, you know, they were underground illegal clubs, they were a little bit more expensive. A bit more of the uptown drinking wasn't as fancy and star-studded, but it was more affordable. One of those main places was Tony's on 52nd Street, which is kind of a cheap place that you could get illegal booze. And the owner, the titular Tony, would give credit, but only if he liked you. And Bogart got 18 months of credit at Tony's on 52nd Street during this time period. He did eventually pay his tab, but he must have been that likable to be granted 18 months of credit at Tony's on 52nd Street. So what his acting salary, you know, during this time lacked, he made up for with charm and chess. What a very interesting combination.
He started playing like mostly juvenile roles and then like, and also maybe the romantic lead. But eventually what would make him famous was playing against that type. So in 1930, he was actually signed to Fox to do films, but it wasn't really the big break he thought it would be. They had him playing a lot of bit parts, and he spent time traveling back and forth from Hollywood to Broadway, all the while his father's health was deteriorating. Right. So he made it back to New York just in time to be with his father when he died. And then he started drinking heavily, and I mean, it was pretty bad. Some of his friends thought that he was suicidal. You could say he was spiraling. Mm-hmm. But it so happens that that is exactly what landed him the role that would soon change his career, because he showed up to his audition for The Petrified Forest completely hungover. And it just happened that his puffy-eyed, apathetic performance was exactly what the director was looking for. And he did really well in the play. So in the original, in The Petrified Forest, original Broadway stage play production, Bogart played Duke Manti, a notorious criminal based on John Dillinger, which was the FBI's first public enemy number one. And then Leslie Howard played the lead. Then Warner Brothers wanted to do a movie version, and they wanted to cast Leslie Howard, but they also wanted to cast Edward G. Robinson as Duke because he was a more bankable actor at the time. But Leslie Howard said he would not do the movie without Bogart. So that's how Bogart actually ended up doing the film. And, you know, it wasn't his first film, but it really solidified his move to Hollywood, which is great timing because the stock market crash happened in 1929. This was like 1933. But the stock market crash was really, really bad for the theater. He moved to the infamous Garden of Allah, which was a rambling hotel. Yes, very fancy. A rambling hotel. And it's like a, they called it a bungalow colony off Sunset Boulevard. I saw one article that said it was a wild place housing some of the finest drinkers in the world.
Okay.
And they had a bar on site that stayed open 24 hours a day.
That's important, I think. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's like that. Yeah. That's a very attractive.
During this time. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. No. So that first big break also solidified the character type that he was going to have for the film studios. At the Warner Brothers studio, he played a lot of criminals and gangsters and like bad guys in cowboy movies. And he took this opportunity very seriously. He was notoriously punctual. He knew his lines really well. And at this point in his career, he limited his drinking to having one beer in his packed lunch. But after hours, it was a little different.
Yeah, I would say I found that very charming that, like, you know, I'm taking myself seriously. Here is the can of beer that I bring to lunch. And a lot of jobs that would be like, well, wait a second. But, you know, compared to the drinking of the day, I think that that was admirable. He did, in his contract, he was very, very serious about how his filming would stop at 6 p.m. every day. Like, that was it. Like, he wanted to have an out time every day. And ready for him at his out time was like his habitual drink. Like his hairdresser, I believe at the time, was the one who would have it ready for him.
It was his hairdresser, and also like she did his hair and also his wigs.
Okay.
You know, because it's, you know, old Hollywood, everybody wears wigs.
Right.
But that would be like the signal that it was time for them to wrap, because she'd be standing just off screen with the scotch water.
She also she had a lot of insider stories on Humphrey Bogart's life. Verita Beauvoir Thompson was his hairdresser, and I mean somebody that was part of his life for like over a decade, who maybe did not have an affair with him. There's conflicting accounts, but she I did like this as far as what he was drinking at the time. She said that they would share loudmouths together, which was his nickname for scotch and soda, because that's what he said she would become, a loudmouth, when they would have a lot of scotch and soda together.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah. I like that. If somebody rolled up to my bar and was like, give me a loudmouth, I'd be like, wow, you know some weird history.
Yeah, I'd be impressed. I'd be pretty impressed. So, you know, like he had that definitely, like, had some kind of, regardless if it was romantic or sexual or whatever, he had some kind of relationship with his hairdresser, bonding over booze. He had many relationships that were defined by his love of drinking. A big part of his image at this time was actually characterized by his third marriage to Mayo Metho. He had married his first two wives, possibly for career advancement. They were both really well-established actresses, as was Mayo. But what he really liked about her is that she was what you might call a spitfire.
Yeah.
She liked drinking as much as he did, and she could really hang with the boys, as they say. But they would brawl. Like, they would throw down. Their wedding night ended in tears. Mayo, like, running off to her girlfriend's place, and Bogart hopping a plane with his buddy, his best man, and some of his groomsmen to go to Tijuana.
That's what you want for your wedding night. Absolutely. The grooms in Tijuana. This is going to be fine.
Yeah. I mean, woof. but they had a pretty long marriage. They were just, like, very well known for this kind of volatile relationship. They would throw plates and glassware. There were several clubs where the couple was banned from appearing on the premises at the same time.
The stories are really there are a lot from it's like,
oh, for sure,
stories of like people coming over to meet with Bogart and just like hearing gunshots from upstairs, and he's like, no, that's just Mayo, she's just shooting off guns, it'll stop,
she's
like,
just playing with the guns. They had the title the Battling Bogarts,
right? Like, one night he called his, I don't know, his buddy or his agent or producer or something. They'll be like, I got a problem, the problem is Mayo stabbed me.
And oh yeah, she literally stabbed she literally stabbed him in the back.
He didn't call the police, he just called
his publicist. Called his publicist, but the doctor came, and they paid him under the table. They bribed him not to tell the authorities. And one of the stories that I heard was, like, he heard the doctor say, like, oh, it's fine, just the tip went in. Like, it was crazy. He had a lot of, like, you know, like, he just, like, that was part of his lifestyles. He drank a lot. It was said that he could drink literally all night, not sleep, somehow make it to set the next day and work and do good work. Although that behavior got him fired from a few plays, but, like, Hollywood is different, you know.
And I mean, you know, they had a very strange relationship, because he often credited Mayo for showing up, like, on set with a thermos full of martinis for him many mornings. And then he would deliver a great performance. He would drink, I guess, a thermos of martinis and then turn in a great show.
Yeah.
While he was still married to Mayo, when World War II happened, Bogart wanted to be of aid in some way. So he was insistent that he got to go abroad and entertain the troops.
Mm-hmm.
And by entertain the troops, it doesn't mean he was necessarily putting on shows. It really just means he was drinking with the troops. And specifically, the troops. He didn't have any time for officers, for generals, for colonels. All of these kind of amazing, outlandish drinking stories come from his time. He went to Africa and he went to Italy specifically. And during that time, like, he brought Mayo with him. What we know he was drinking at the time comes from an account that Mayo wrote home about being distressed that all they could ever drink was cheap cognac that tasted like burnt motor oil, as she described it. But Bogart didn't really seem to care about that, because he was still getting toasted. And There's like a story of him. He got drunk with a bunch of troops. One of them gave him a uniform to put on. And so then he's like wandering around this encampment in like a uniform, and a colonel approaches him and just sees this drunk troop wandering around, and he like demands to know his name and his rank and his serial number and all this. Doesn't recognize him as Humphrey Bogart. And Bogart replies, "I've got no name, I've got no rank, I've got no serial number, and you can go to hell." later, he was reprimanded for this and asked to apologize for insulting the uniform of the United States Army. And he apologized to the colonel by saying, "I didn't mean to insult the uniform. I meant to insult you." it's just, I think, you know, from youth, Bogart has had a bit of an anti-establishment like vein in him.
For sure.
You know, he was there for the everyman. He was not there for the captains and the generals. The thing that finally got him sent home, he was no longer allowed to provide his services to the United States Army, was he was, you know, late at night partying with a bunch of troops. And a general that was like stationed across the hall from where they were drinking came in and said, "I need you to be quiet." And he just frankly told him to fuck off. Like, and that was it. After that, he was asked to go back to Hollywood.
Right. He was like super sympathetic to the common man. And another example of that came about when Bogart was hungover on set and he was refusing to work. Instead, he rode around the lot on a bicycle in his pajamas, shouting, "Look, no hands, no hands." And finally, Jack Warner himself came out to talk to him, and he was like, "Yes," he was like, "Bogey, what the hell are you doing?" And he says, "Riding my bicycle." And Jack Warner says, "It's time to go to work." Bogey says, "I don't feel like working." He says, "You don't, huh?" "That's right, I don't." "Well," Warner said, "there's a lot of people in there who feel like working, and they get paychecks that are less than you spend on scotch." So very ashamed, Bogart kind of sheepishly dismounted his bike and went to work.
Well, but I do think, like, you know, his support of the working man or of people in need, like, I thought he's something he's known for, I should say. But like, there were blacklisted actors that he would demand, once he had power, he demanded were put on scripts and put on projects with him. He actually, weirdly enough, was like his sister growing up had battled with depression, so, you know, he actually like helped co-stars like get help for their depression. So he was a very he did some good for people around him, like,
for sure. And I want to like get in a little bit later more of his activism, but I don't want to jump ahead.
We're not
too
there
much
yet.
So like most of his really good relationships were actually built on his love of booze. So besides his third wife Mayo, he befriended producer Mark Hellinger while filming High Sierra. This goes into why he drinks scotch, so why don't you tell us about that?
Well, that's what Hellinger is famously the reason that he changed up his drinking habits from everything he learned during Prohibition. Hellinger made fun of Bogart, saying that he drinks like a kid. And after that, he switched mainly to just scotch. So that's
right.
So he tried to upgrade his drinking. He's actually quoted as saying, "Scotch is a very valuable part of my life." That's a Bogart quote.
Yeah, it is. I think that might also because of like the people and the relationships he had from like drinking scotch, because that was like a huge thing. On the set of High Sierra, he met Mark Hellinger, but he also met one of the co-writers, John Huston, John Huston got the green light to direct The Maltese Falcon. And after George Raft turned it down for not being important enough, John Huston decided to cast Bogart as the lead, and they quickly became friends and also drinking buddies. Also, this is like This is another thing that I thought was really interesting. He had like a huge, and this will come back to John Huston. He's another huge part of this, but Bogart had a really big reputation for drinking a lot and hardly ever eating.
He was definitely not a foodie, the man.
No.
He ate because he had to, and he ate to survive.
Yeah. The owner of his favorite restaurant, Mike Romanoff, said Bogey didn't really enjoy food. He only ate to stay alive. And he would, the order that he had at that restaurant was 2 scotch and sodas, French toast, and brandy. And he never even looked at the menu. But on one occasion, Bogart's drinking actually saved him from physical suffering, because while he was filming The African Queen with Katharine Hepburn, a lot of their shoot took place in the Congo. And by all accounts, that was like a really rough time, because the first campsite actually had to be burned down after 2 weeks because it became infested with fire ants, which originally their really tight schedule accounted for the fire ants eventually taking over in 30 days. But they didn't actually have that much time. It was like 2 weeks. But that wasn't the only problem, because the water they were able to collect gave nearly everyone in the cast and crew, including Katharine Hepburn, dysentery, which is not nice.
And she famously, on the first day of shooting, before any of this went down, she walked into, so this is important to note, like, John Huston had built a bar tent at the center of the set. Like, he had made sure there was a place, there's a bar tent.
Yes, of course.
So Bogart and Huston are drinking at the bar tent on day one of shooting, and Hepburn walks in and delivers this beautiful, eloquent speech about the evils of alcohol. Because, I mean, Hepburn was mainly a teetotaler. She mainly did not drink. So she's like, oh, it's terrible for you, and the evils of alcohol. And Bogart, you know, respectfully waits till she's done and says, "You're absolutely right, Kate. Now sit down and have a drink," which she refuses to do. She does not do.
Not at that point. Not at that point. But after, like, it was, they said that Hepburn actually kept a bucket just right off screen so that she could vomit in between takes. But director John Huston and Humphrey Bogart were the only ones in the production to not suffer from dysentery due to them drinking more whiskey than water.
Yes, they drank only scotch, more or less.
Yeah.
She has great quotes about them. She said, "Those two undisciplined weaklings had so lined their insides with alcohol that no bug could live in that atmosphere." And Bogart agreed with her. He said, "I built a solid wall of scotch between me and the bugs. If a mosquito bit me, he'd fall over dead drunk."
Yeah, absolutely. But she eventually came around and actually began drinking champagne, because it's classy, you know.
It's like, I like her response. She said, "It was a really good joke on me, especially as I privately had felt so completely superior to that unhealthy pair." Forced to drink champagne on set. You have to wonder, and I mean, I've got a rundown of some of his on-screen drinking, but as far as The African Queen is involved, like, there's a scene where Katharine Hepburn gets to, like, throw liquor overboard. It's part, like, you know, like the...
Yes!
And you just, that must have been a moment of method acting for her, or just pure release, like...
Absolutely.
God damn you, dudes.
Now that you mentioned that, I think it's worth mentioning that that was the first... Like, that was some really good product placement in this film, and that was really one of the first films to utilize that advertising technique, because what she's throwing overboard is Gordon's dry gin.
Yeah, and they paid, that was the first alcohol company ever to actually pay for liquor to be advertised in a film. And I mean, Bogart's character, who is Charlie Allnut, the captain of the ship, like, he's seen drinking Gordon's throughout the movie. Mm-hmm. It kind of associated Bogart with gin in a way that wasn't really accurate, but that was the initial instance of alcohol being advertised at product placement in a film. Got some miles out of it.
His character drank gin. That doesn't mean Bogart drinks gin.
No, yeah, which we'll get back to that. I think we got a little bit of his life still to go.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the same time that Bogart's career was taking off, his marriage to Mayo became increasingly rockier. And while filming Casablanca, Mayo was extremely jealous of Ingrid Bergman, even though, despite their on-screen chemistry, Bogart and Bergman never had an affair.
Right.
But she did threaten him that if he had an affair, she would kill him, which was pretty believable. I mean, think about the things that she's already done. She's literally stabbed him in the back. She shot his suitcase full of bullet holes. When they were filming Casablanca, nobody really expected it to be what it would be. And even at the time, it wasn't appreciated. The thing that really changed his relationship was that he started filming a movie called To Have and Have Not, based on a book by Ernest
Hemingway. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
And the lead opposite Bogart was Lauren Bacall, who was a very young actress who was found by the director's wife, who was nicknamed Slim. She found her. She was like a model at the time. And there was like a quote that was like, I don't know if she can act or not, but she can certainly look at you. And that was by the director's wife, who he actually kind of modeled this character based on. Bogart did begin having at least an emotional affair with right. Lauren Bacall. Like, she was 19 at the time, you know, like she didn't really have that much experience, but she was playing this very cool character, and Bogart really fell for that, as did just like everyone who came in contact with that. Everybody who saw the movie was really infatuated with this idea of this like cool customer that Lauren Bacall was playing. Bogart was unhappy with his marriage to Mayo, but he felt really obligated to his wife. He wasn't really ready to end the marriage. There was, however, some late night meetings and parked cars and many tender letters exchanged between Bogart and Bacall after the film was completed. Then when they were paired again for The Big Sleep, Bogart began calling Bacall after disputes with Mayo. And Mayo was really struggling at this point. She promised to stop drinking. She would fall back into it. She became really ill. She promised to stop again. Then she returned to old habits when she got out of the hospital. And it took a long time for Bogart to make the decision, but they finally divorced in 1945. And then Bogart and Bacall were married the same year. He and Bacall had a somewhat surprisingly political stint. As I mentioned before, he'd always been really sympathetic to the common man. So when a bunch of Hollywood screenwriters were accused of being communists by the House of Un-American Activities, Bogart helped to organize the Committee for the First Amendment, along with the support of a lot of other big names in Hollywood, including Judy Garland, Katharine Hepburn was in there. Just like a lot of stars at the time were really raising their voice in support of free speech. Warner Brothers at the time was really known for making movies that actually had a social/political commentary, which was not all of Hollywood, but like Warner Brothers specifically was doing that. Jack Warner volunteered to appear before HUAC, presumably to get ahead of the accusations, but when he came to court, he really panicked and he named names. He really...
That's the opposite of what you were supposed to do?
Yeah, no, he really did poorly. There's a story that his son told where he gets off of the podium and he walks away with his son and he says something to the effect of like, I didn't do very well, right? Like, I was kind of an asshole. Like, I shouldn't have named names. But, you know, I mean, it was the Red Scare. It was like, it was a really big thing where people were really afraid of, like, people were just sort of getting their First Amendment rights taken away. They were just being put in jail for, on the premise of being communists, which shouldn't be, I mean, that's part of what we expect of the American Constitution anyway, is that you can have any ideology that you want as long as what you do doesn't break the law. So, you know, just like thinking and like putting forth these ideas in a screenwriting way, like that really shouldn't be a thing like that. Like, you shouldn't go to jail for that. But it was really scary for a lot of people, especially a lot of people in Hollywood that were using their artistic voice to do something like that. So Bogart and the other stars in the committee actually boarded a plane to New York. They all got on a plane together to rally support for the accused. But then when they got there, what the stars observed was the screenwriters taking the stand and like being kind of less composed than what they would expect of themselves. They were, you know, they were yelling. It didn't look good. And Bogart was really embarrassed by that. So, and as well were a lot of the stars. So some of them even left early and got their own plane ticket back to Hollywood. And it was just like a really big embarrassment for Bogart being kind of one of the main organizers of this committee. So rather than be shunned from stardom, Bogart wrote an article entitled "I'm No Communist." And that is why he wrote this. It simply painted himself and the rest of the stars in the committee as sort of like impassioned American dopes, saying that their venture had been misguided. And it's really kind of sad because the purpose of the committee was to protect free speech, but the Red Scare was so prevalent in the American psyche that ultimately most everyone just chose their careers over their First Amendment rights.
Well, yeah. He did, like, you know, like I mentioned earlier, he did help blacklisted actors stay employed, but it was sort of on a case-by-case basis, something that he could do in like a personal situation and not on a grand scale,
which for sure. I mean,
that was the power of that propaganda, is that everybody, if you ended up blacklisted, you lost everything.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
On a, I guess, a lighter note. So I, you know, we said earlier that even though his drinking was a little notorious during his Bacall era, he was very well behaved on set. He really only had one major incident, and that was when he was shooting Sabrina in 1954, which, as an aside, his reflections on that movie are kind of funny because it's very much like, who is she going to fall in love with? Audrey Hepburn lead, like, movie. And halfway through, he was like, I don't care who Sabrina loves. I don't care. I'm done with this. Like, he was very over his own role and over the movie kind of over early on. But he threatened at one point to walk off set. He threatened to leave the movie and call, like, his publicist to get him out of it. And when asked why, it was because his co-stars, William Holden, Audrey Hepburn, the director, Billy Wilder, they were going out drinking after shooting and they didn't invite him. And that hurt his feelings so deeply that he threatened to walk off the movie. It's, you know, this is a man that prides himself on being good drinking company. So I guess that was pretty close to home. Now, obviously, offset during this time period was another story. He was not so well behaved. During all of his drinking shenanigans, he only had one major run-in with the law. And that happened during his marriage to Bacall. He dropped her off at, you know, their hotel around midnight, and then he kept partying at this, like, New York, like, chic club, the El Morocco Club. And he was there with an old Broadway drinking buddy. And I guess because both of their dates had gone home, they decided to get new dates. So they picked up a couple of stuffed pandas that they saw at a store window. And that's who they were going to go out drinking with.
I think that's a good choice. That's great.
Yeah, so they decided to roll into this, like, super fancy club with these two stuffed pandas as their dates. And two young socialites that were there decided to make it their mission to steal these pandas from them.
Oh, how dare they?
Well, there are a lot of conflicting stories. Basically, you know, like, what happened is, well, one of the girls was trying to steal the panda from Bogart. Bogart wrestled it out of her hands. She may or may not have fallen to the floor, but her boyfriend was a mobster at the time. So,
like,
that was
a real life mobster.
Like a real mobster, like actual gang member. And
not
that,
like the ones that Humphrey had played.
No, like real ass, like he was going to get in trouble for that. And and because of the you know, the presence of the mafia at the time, like, crossing somebody in the organization was not a great idea.
No.
So while he went to court, it was thrown out of court as nonsense. He was banned from something like 15 clubs, like the El Morocco banned him, but so did a bunch of others. And I mean, his account in court is great. Like he argues like, you know, this is a free country, isn't it? I can take my panda any place I want. If I want to buy my panda a drink, that's my business. Like he was just absolutely absurd. Like could not handle it. And Bacall just being cool as ever, her response would always like, you got to hand it to him. When he gets barred from all the right places.
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah. She's so cool.
Yeah. So he wasn't actually charged with anything, but just, you know, because he crossed the wrong people, he was kicked out of a lot of clubs at that time.
Right. I mean, cool. He was known for his antics. Like I found a story that's like after one morning, after a long night of drinking, he followed the smell of bacon drifting outside the window of a home where a woman was cooking breakfast for her family. And she noticed him leering outside the window and screamed, "My God, it's Humphrey Bogart. What about him?" was what her husband said. And she said, "He's standing in our front yard. Well, invite him in."
I love the
idea. He just like came in and had breakfast with his family.
Yeah. And like just told him stories about his film career. Like that's, how do you ever top that story? Yeah. Like, how was your week? Well, Humphrey Bogart had breakfast with us. Like, that's like that the Bill Murray stealing your French fries like modern story, but this is Humphrey Bogart sitting down with a nice breakfast.
Wow. That was just like what he did. I mean, that was one of the nicer things he did. One time he rolled a safe out of a club with Peter Lorre and they just left it in the middle of the road. Like, you know, it's just like that was what he was known for. He just had antics. Like, that's just, you know, that's him.
His marriage to Bacall, it didn't lessen his drinking. I don't even think it lessened his partying, but he did party a lot more at home. They had a beautiful home in the Hollywood Hills together. They had this beautiful room in the center of it all. It was called it was like an all wood paneled room called the Butternut Room. I'm guessing that's because of the stain on the wood paneling. I don't know.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, had all of these like beautiful like bookcases and then also a very well-stocked bar. And this really became the epicenter of Bogart and Bacall's like entertaining in Hollywood. I want to like just imagine this scene where you've got like you got Bogey and Bacall like just hanging out. They're hosting. You've got like Sinatra.
Oh, Sinatra stopped by.
Yeah. Frank Sinatra's making everybody martinis at the bar. So you're going to get to drink a martini made by Frank Sinatra. You've got like Judy Garland like just chilling.
Yeah, Judy like and Sid.
Spencer Tracy just hanging out. Like,
Cary Grant.
Cary Grant. Yeah, just like imagine this. Just like beautiful like Hollywood royalty in a beautiful bar space. Just gossiping and drinking all night long. Like,
I want to be at that party.
I know. Like, I don't want to buy into like celebrity worship, and I don't think I do in modern time. But when I think about the past, it's hard not to, because these people are just like iconic and just.
I
want to
party with Judy Garland. Like, oh, that's well, like. Who doesn't? That's mostly what I'm interested in.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, and this formed the basis for, I think you've got a bit more on this story, but a very important drinking club that would form in Hollywood.
Oh, for sure. So at first they called them the Freeloaders Club is what they called themselves. And I'm very excited that Judy Garland was part of this club. but like they had all gone to a Noelle Coward play. And that turned into a 5-day bender where they were just drinking all day and night. And so after 5 days, a very unimpressed Lauren Bacall comes down and looks at them and says, "You look like a goddamn rat pack." and that's thus, where the name stuck.
Yeah.
Yeah. So actually, you know, Bogart would later pass on, and that is what Sinatra continued to call the Rat Pack. And there were obviously there's very famous members of that particular Rat Pack, but this is where it started.
Oh,
and Judy Garland was there.
I like that Judy Garland was part of the original Rat Pack.
Yes. I really like that.
Well, yeah, so I mean, you know, tragically Bogart was diagnosed with esophageal cancer. He had surgery. It was somewhat unsuccessful. He had to go on chemo after that. He didn't have long to live. His friends continued to gather. He continued to host. Bacall stayed by his side through all this. And while his drinking did not stop, Bacall did sort of allow him certain doses of scotch cut with water and ice, like twice a day.
Yeah, so, very moderate doses. I think it was like one ounce of scotch with a couple ice cubes and then topped with water. Like, he got like one before lunch and two more before dinner. It's fine. I mean, when you think about it, it's 3 ounces of scotch. Like, okay.
Yeah, he's
dying.
And he died how he lived, because that's one of the things that he just kind of was never willing to sacrifice.
Yeah.
How he wanted to live his life for better living. He was aware of that. He was a smoker his whole life, too. Like, when we were talking about his drinking, he was a smoker. And it was ultimately.
That's what ultimately killed him. It wasn't the drinking.
No. He has so many great quotes. We mentioned the one about scotch. You know, there's the other one that I think I love, that is that the whole world is three drinks behind.
Yes.
If everyone in the world would take three drinks, we would have no trouble. If Stalin, Truman, and everybody else in the world had three drinks right now, we'd all loosen up and we wouldn't need the United Nations. Like, he also said he didn't trust a man that didn't drink, because it was someone that wouldn't reveal their true self. Like, he had a lot of great quotes about drinking, but one that is attributed to him that I think the argument holds that is incorrect is the one that is, it's his last words. And that's right. That supposedly he said, "I should have never switched from scotch to martinis." Now, this is probably false for a couple reasons. For one, and the most obvious, is this quote doesn't come about until the 70s. So at this part, Bogart has been dead for a while. the other is that we have on record that Bacall was making him scotch waters up until the day he died.
Yeah, he's still drinking scotch.
Yeah, he never switched. He drank scotch his whole life, you know?
Yeah.
He enjoyed a martini, but scotch was his drink of choice. And then the other is that I think a far more like meaningful truth is that people that were there with him in the hospital ward said that his last words were actually to Bacall, and that she was about to leave to go pick up the kids from school, and he just said, you know, "Goodbye, kid, hurry back." And then he lapsed into the coma that he would not awaken from. So his last words, while less quotable on like a whiskey bottle, were to his wife, and they were very sweet.
Very sweet, very sentimental, very like indicative of the part of himself that he really put into his characters, and that's why he was so captivating. He was only 57 years old.
Yeah, he was young.
Yeah, but he was greatly beloved and missed dearly by his friends. So many stars at the time came to his funeral, and that's not to like give him clout. That's just to say, like, that's the people that were really his true friends were the people he worked with, and his legacy was kind of defined by. John Huston did a speech at his funeral, and to paraphrase, it was that he took his work very seriously, but he never took himself too seriously. And there's actually a Bogart quote that kind of embodies that. So Humphrey Bogart himself said, "People who live in glass houses need earplugs and a sense of humor."
I like that.
Yeah, he goes on to say, "When I chose to be an actor, I knew I'd be working in the spotlight. I also knew that the higher a monkey climbs, the more you can see of his tail. So I keep my sense of humor and go right on leading my life and enjoying it. I wouldn't trade places with anybody."
I think that's a really useful perspective, because I do think, you know, it seems like there's consistent attempts to sort of defame his character, but he never shied away from who he was. And, you know, maybe he drank too much and maybe he smoked too much. And ultimately, those were the things that cost him his life. But he lived true to who he was. And I don't know. It's hard to fault a man for doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he only, like, for like the actor that we remember him today, he only won one Academy Award in his lifetime.
And
it wasn't for Casablanca. It was for The African Queen. He won the Academy Award for that. He got nominated for Casablanca.
I do want to say I did find one thing that was very charming about his Academy Award acceptance speech was that he said beforehand that anybody that wins shouldn't thank anybody but themselves. Just go up there and say, I did this myself. And then when he actually did, he went up and was like, yeah, yeah, I got a lot of people. I got people to thank. Like, it's kind of very, epitome of who he was perceived as like someone that, I mean, and you know, you read these accounts of like, he was very intimidating as like a conversationalist. Like, he had no problem being sharp and cutting and sarcastic and a person with a lot of edges. But like, ultimately, when pushed, he's like, I gotta thank people. I'm not gonna stand up and be that much of an asshole. Which I think is the character he also consistently played, like what he was famous for playing. In his best roles, that's exactly who he was. On the topic of his roles, I do want to talk a little bit about his on-screen drinking, because I think it's almost as iconic as his off-screen drinking. Almost. Like you mentioned, one of his first career-making plays that was eventually a movie was The Petroid Forest. And in that movie, and he's seen drinking beer, but that's really the kind of... From there, as he evolves into a leading man, his tastes evolve with him. In The Maltese Falcon, you see him playing, of course, Sam Spade. He pours drinks for himself from an obscure bottle, which people have thought might be whiskey or might be scotch, because that was Bogart's preference. But if you look to the book, it actually says that Sam Spade was a fan of straight Bacardi, which is rough stuff. I can't, I don't know, but it's hard to say what was on set, but that's supposedly what Sam Spade was a fan of. he also mixes coffee and brandy as a little, like, let's stay up late, little pep-me-up drink in The Maltese Falcon. And of course, he drinks a very unfortunate whiskey and soda that was cut with a little something extra to knock him out, so.
Ha!
Yeah. Now, you might think that his film To Have and Have Not, which is really the spiritual connection between two great drinkers, Hemingway and Bogart, would feature a lot of drinking. And it does. Drinking is a major plot point in this movie. The character he plays, which is a Captain Morgan that is a much superior Captain Morgan to the one we talked about in the past.
Yes. I mean, you don't really have far to go to get superior to that.
No. This Captain Morgan, he's a rum runner, and he, you know, he has a relationship. His best friend is an alcoholic. They call him a rummy, which is somehow I find that a very cute term for somebody that drinks too much rum, I guess.
Cute.
It's just a little rummy. Yeah, it's a rummy. Sad state, but it's a cute word. You know, his best friend's alcoholism plays heavily into the plot of To Have and Have Not. And also, on screen, we see Hemingway choosing to drink rum over American whiskey because, hey, he's in the Caribbean. That's what you drink. In the classic film noir, The Big Sleep, Bogart, of course, famously plays the private eye, Philip Marlowe, and he keeps it very simple in the movie. He drinks scotch out of a paper cup. He drinks...
A paper cup?
Yeah. He's asked how he likes his brandy. He says, in a glass. So, neat brandy. But the one cocktail that actually people have pulled out of The Big Sleep that they make more often actually comes via Marlowe's client, who is General Sternwood. And in this discussion over how you like your brandy, he says he likes his with champagne. So if you want a companion cocktail for that, it's brandy and champagne. If you don't want to drink
that kind of scotch, sounds good.
Yeah. If you don't want to drink warm brandy or scotch in a paper cup, any of it works, though. Now, I do want to talk about the most iconic, I think, on-screen alcohol-related performance for Humphrey Bogart, and that is Casablanca. Mm-hmm. Casablanca is one of my favorite movies, maybe my favorite bar adjacent movie. It's a fascinating window into cocktail culture in a very specific part of the world at the time. It's very accurate. And in that I mean, like, what you're dealing with is a bar that's an expat bar, but it's mainly like dealing with European expats in Africa and Morocco modern day. So you're dealing with a drinking palate that was not affected by prohibition. There's only two cocktails made in the entire movie. The majority of what you see imbibed is, like, you know, whiskey, brandy, straight spirits, slightly modified, which was the style of drinking and cocktailing before Prohibition and before cocktail culture really had made its impact. It's still in the early days of making its way over from the Americas. What you see Rick, obviously a Bogart's character in the movie, what you see him drink mainly, it's not really, you don't really see the label, but it's assumed to be a bottle of American whiskey. He reminisces about it. So it's probably a whiskey. It's some sort of amber spirit that he seems to drink straight. The other characters in the movie, obviously Victor Laszlo, the sort of love rival, but also, you know, political spearhead, very important character in the movie. He orders originally, I thought this was interesting when I first watched it. He orders straight Cointreau for him and his wife. And then deciding it was a celebratory cocktail, he asked instead for a champagne cocktail. Now, both of those orders are interesting because the idea of drinking straight Cointreau, I mean, I think a lot of orange liqueurs get maligned because we think of them all as the same. Grand Marnier, Cointreau, Cambier, Triple Sec, they're all the same thing, right? But they're all wildly different. Some are based in brandy. Some are based in grain spirits. Some can be derived from potato spirits. Like, you know, they can be had added sugar. Some don't. So the idea of drinking a glass of straight triple sec in today's day and age sounds terrible, but Cointreau is a very specific product that's pretty well balanced, and at the time would have been a popular like aperitif, like a you know, before dinner sweet drink to get the digestive juices flowing. That makes sense. And then champagne cocktail, what you're dealing with there is just good quality champagne, a sugar cube, some bitters, a splash of cognac. So a bit adjacent to the other cocktail that's ordered the movie, where this is actually, I think, for me, it's kind of one of the, it's kind of funny and weird. It's that, so Rick's character has this, like, dalliance, this female that he, I guess, is sort of involved with, who shows up at the bar with her new Nazi lover, and they order French 75s. A French 75 is an interesting drink because that is named after a piece of French artillery that was developed during this time. So, I don't know. Kind of just a funny, like, it's a bit of an, it's a light, delicious drink that has a bit of an insidious name because it's named after a big old gun. Yeah. Casablanca as a drinking movie is just, it's a really specific window to, like, it's European drinking culture, like, not quite influenced yet by American cocktail culture or what Prohibition did to cocktail culture. So it's really an object in and of itself, where you see people drinking, like, finely made straight spirits, or in the case of the two champagne cocktails featured, it relies on good champagne with very slight modifiers added to it. So, which was more the style of the day at the time, like, especially in Europe. Cocktails weren't really a thing unless they were just, you took a good spirit and you modified it very slightly. Casablanca is, like, as a bar movie, it's just the character of Rick is just, I know we're gonna do a live watch along about it at some point, but, like, it's just really, I think it might be the best movies adjacent to a bar that there is out there. I don't know if there's a better one, but
Coyote Ugly.
hard argument there, you're right. And then, of course, the last movie that I have some notes on, which we've kind of already talked about, is The African Queen, filmed in 1951. And that is, of course, the first representation of alcohol being, like, a paid appearance of a liquor brand on screen with Gordon's gin. Bogart is seen loading it onto the ship. Katharine Hepburn is seen throwing it over the ship. And this is also probably where the association with Humphrey Bogart and gin came about. Because this was one of the movies in his later careers. It was just a few years before he unfortunately passed. And so he definitely became tied to gin during this time period. Even though, as we discussed, off screen during this, he was still drinking scotch. He was a scotch man.
Oh, bogey.
He's an interesting figure. He did a lot of good. He made a lot of iconic roles. But he was definitely a troubled figure. It's been discussed, like, you know, his drinking has been attributed to, like, childhood trauma or insecurities, and then some people have postulated maybe he just liked to drink.
I feel like there is, I mean, you know, you can't really say that out of everyone, but for Humphrey Bogart, it kind of just seems like, yeah, he just enjoyed it, and he he formed a lot of really good relationships that way. I think that was how he liked to socialize. And the idea that he believed that that was a way of being truthful with yourself. Right. Like, it was kind of a way for him to, it was kind of an excuse for him to be vulnerable and to kind of bond with the people that he was working with and for them to be vulnerable too.
Yeah.
Sometimes it went a little bit out of hand. I mean, arguably a lot of his relationships were kind of tumultuous, but in the long run, like, it seems like he just wanted to really live truthfully, you know? I like his philosophy. I mean, I don't know if I can handle drinking as much as he did, but I don't really mind the way that he went about it, you know?
It's never a comfortable, like, topic to say, like, he was clearly, I mean, to say he was an alcoholic, I think is fair.
Yes.
He was definitely an alcoholic. He has that one quote, like, I tried to stop drinking once. It was the worst afternoon of my life. Something along those lines. Yeah. And then, like, and I don't think that's a downplay of just how much it was integrated into his life. And
yeah.
Is that the healthiest way to go about? Absolutely not.
No way.
And absolutely not encouraging that. But
no.
For the work that he produced and the man that he was, I mean, I think you just have to look, and I think that's what he asked for over and over again. You know, I mean, there's another quote where he says, like, you know, you, all you owe your audience is the performance, which is, I think, something that's not direct as well, but it's along the lines of, like, what I owe you is what I'm giving to you. I'm giving to you my performance. I'm giving you my craft, my art. Who I am is who I am, and that that he's.
I don't owe you that. Yeah,
and I don't know. Like, he's an interesting character. You know, people have definitely conflicting opinions on him, but I think with a lot of these people, and, you know, anytime we're talking about somebody who is famous for their drinking, you're gonna run into the hey, alcoholism is always bad, but does that mean that the person is bad? Absolutely not.
No,
that's just part of his character, and it's something that he clearly grappled with and found a way to live alongside of.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, he died a little too young, but he left behind a really beautiful legacy and some really great films, some really monumental films for the time.
Yeah. Why is his character so iconic? And I feel like he really is kind of the epitome of his time frame, like, to grow up between World War One and Prohibition and World War II and the Depression. Like, he has that, I think, in his best roles. He embodies this, I've had the shit beaten out of me, and yet I still want to be good. I don't trust a lot, but I want to. And I think that, like, there's a bit of the American psyche that he embodied in that, where,
oh, for sure,
after witnessing so much pain and so much death, but you still want to believe in goodness, you still want to help your fellow man. I think his both the characters that he was cast as, but also him as you know, as the character, struck that chord with a lot of Americans and obviously people around the world.
Yeah. Well, damn. Cheers to you, Bogan.
Yeah.
Oh.
We're gonna continue this Bogart celebration, I guess, this whole week. We're gonna do. Have we figured out if we can do a live watch along? Is that something we can do with Casablanca? We'll figure it out.
Stay tuned for that, because we're gonna announce. Probably it's gonna be the day before. We'll announce when we're gonna do it. If we can give you a little bit more notice, we will do that too. But we are going to do a live watch along of Casablanca because, oh my God, we have to. Yeah. So we're gonna do that, and then we're this Friday. We're going to bring you a live stream that features possibly some of the drinks that Humphrey Bogart liked to drink, because there are so many to choose from. So we can definitely do that for you. Yeah. Okay.
You don't watch us drink scotch and try to say quotable bits.
We'll try.
We'll just needle each other for an hour. See what lands.
Yeah, but so join us for that this Friday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, because we are in New York. So if you are on the West Coast, it's going to be 5:30. If you're Central, it's going to be 7:30. But we will keep you guys updated on that. And thank you so much for joining us on those live streams. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for being supporters of this podcast while we're still in our first year of this. And thank you for everybody who has supported us on Patreon and everybody who's upped their donations. That's crazy good. Like, we never imagined that you would do that. That's so nice.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much, because we literally could not do this without you. And also thank you to Absurdist for our theme music, which again is 20 seconds long. So that's how long you should wash your hands.
Perfect hand washing music.
Yes.
All right. Well, I've been Taylor Smurl.
And I've been Liz June.
And this has been
Neat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Drink some scotch.
Drink some scotch.
With some pandas.